Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we are trying to reach my guest, Frank Joseph, and I believe he's on his phone line, and so as soon as we're able to get to him, we will do exactly that. Meanwhile, we are going to start the programming, and if you'd like to call into the show, 888-627-6008 is the phone number to call into. Indecision. Oh, my goodness, don't we all face that at one time or another? And I really think when it comes to being indecisive, usually it's because we don't have enough information. We really haven't given a lot of thought to the choices that may be available to us. And another side of it is that we get scared. We really honestly get scared. Have you ever had an occasion where you're going to step into an area of the unknown? You're going to try something you've never done before. And so frequently, we are indoctrinated that we've got to be safe. And this isn't all bad. We need to think things through. What if we're going to make a business decision that may put us at risk? Dare we do that? Or when it comes to a relationship, are we willing to explore a new environment, meeting new people? There's so much that indecisiveness causes us to experience. Well, apparently the rich and famous also have that challenge. And this is a story, perhaps you've heard it before, but I really like it. It's about former President Ronald Reagan. And he liked to use the power of story, especially his own personal experiences, about how he learned at quite a young age how to make firm and resolute decisions. And this is how his story was told about himself. He had an aunt that he just dearly loved, and she really, really liked to pamper him. Well, this one day, she took him to a cobbler. Now, in our day, we probably think, cobbler? What is a cobbler? Well, you have to remember, Ronald Reagan was born many years ago when shoemakers and cobblers were pretty common. And she took him to a cobbler to have a pair of shoes custom made for him. Now, the shoemaker asked him a very simple question. Do you want a square toe or a round one? Now, he was quite young at the time, and he thought and he thought and he thought, and he couldn't make up his mind. So the cobbler said, come back in a day or two and tell me what you want. Well, it was a few days later, and the shoemaker saw Ronald Reagan on the street and asked what he had decided about the shoes. Ronald Reagan said, well, you know, I haven't made up my mind. Remember, he was quite young. Very well, the cobbler said to him, and he announced to Ronald, your shoes will be ready tomorrow. When Ronald Reagan got the shoes, one shoe had a round toe, and the other had a square toe. That was quite a lesson. He said, when I had to look at those shoes every day and wear them, it taught me a lesson. If you don't make your own decisions, someone else will make them for you. When you don't make a decision, it is a decision. And I recall a number of years ago when someone made that comment to me. When you choose not to make a decision, you actually have made one. Indecisiveness is going to put you perhaps in a positioning you do not want to find yourself in. Ronald Reagan had his lesson. We all go through our own lessons. sometimes when we turn things over to other people and we are not really decisive, we just sort of let things go, we find that that lack of decisiveness puts us into a bind. And Lord knows that has happened to me more than once. Now, why has that, in my own personal experience, happened? Usually it's because I have wanted to avoid conflict. And it's something that I think all of us go through. Avoiding conflict is not always a good thing. We have to learn that it's okay for us to speak up and speak out. And there were a number of experiences that I had when I had been taught that it was not my place to speak up and to speak out, that I would literally just quiver with fear because I was going against what I had been indoctrinated as a young woman that were proper things to do. You were not to say anything. You were just to absorb, and you were to just move on without making comment. If you stop and think about some of the greatest lessons you have in life, they usually come with a great deal of discomfort. I've never found that wisdom typically is gained through a lot of sweetness and light. Usually, life hands us lessons, and it comes along with a sledgehammer special. And so we wake up, we pay attention. Something has caused us to recognize that we need to change what we do. We need to change our attitudes, our actions, our plans. We need to wake up. Indecisiveness can be a very good teacher, just like it was with Ronald Reagan. That is a significant lesson. How many lessons are you going to be able to absorb and learn in your own way? It's something we have to think about. Donna Sebo here, and we have an open mic time here. We're trying to reach my guest, Frank Joseph, the Lost Colonies of Ancient America. We were going to be discussing today, so we are trying to get through to him at this time. So as soon as we do, we'll let you know and bring him onto the air to share his information. Well, I have been sharing different things with you regarding your winter horoscope. Woo-hoo! Well, isn't it wonderful when you can have something like this and just have fun with it? I really think it's important. I say at the end of every show, remember always you're the master of your fate. You're the captain of your soul. There is a reason I use those words, and the reason I use the words is because you have the opportunity to really be more than what you could ever imagine. So when I share these little tidbits with you, understand that's what they are. They're just sort of guidelines. Astrology is a marvelous tool. It is not meant to imprison you. It is meant to give you leverage. It is meant to help you understand the greater part of yourself and your potentialities, and to move with them. It is not something to be feared. It is something to be utilized as a tool. So, here you go. We have already covered Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Libra, Scorpio, and Sagittarius. So, we're going to be chatting about those of you under the sign of Cancer, Leo, and Virgo. This is what's going to be going on for you this winter season. Well, you know what? You are going to be more determined and decisive and walking the walk, not just talking the talk. There's a shift inside of you. Those of you born under the sign of Cancer, it's as if you're doing a lot of introspection. You're challenging yourself. You're wondering, what is right for me? What am I going to be doing that is going to make a difference? You want to set an example of demonstration, not just yakety-yak, demonstration. And that is very important. And your relationships in your life are going to be affected very, very strongly by this positioning. Now, your personal life seems to be thriving because of this, and you are going to determine that you want to balance between working and playing. And this is extremely important for you because you have a tendency to go to either extreme. And I'm looking at the fact that those of you with that strong Cancer strength in your life, that balance is going to be very, very much determined by you, not by somebody else. And you are going to have a strong positioning. And you're going to decide that you really want to move forward into the direction that's going to be best suited for you. You're going to do a lot of thinking about this. You're going to take downtime to really think through what's most important to you, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So you have got a dynamic winner on more than one level, and you're going to be pleased with the result if you give yourself that time. Those of you under the sign of Leo, wow, you always enjoy surging forward. You just really, really like having a frontal positioning in everything that you do. And I want you to take a positioning with your education. I want you to take joy in the lessons of learning that can bring so much fulfillment and satisfaction into your life. Now, imagination, you're going to be putting it to work in a very, very special way. You're going to find that you also, because of your creative self, will be able to enhance your financial area of your environment on so many levels, whether you're in business for yourself, thinking about going into business, your association with other people is going to give you some wonderful, wonderful leverage. But you're also going to really enjoy being able to establish yourself in a very, very positive way. Family is going to be very important to you. If there have been disagreements with certain members of the family, it's as if you're wanting to resolve them. There is a going forward into 2014 with a clarity that perhaps you've not had for the last few years. This is happening now, and it seems like you're affected by so many things that you're observing. It's as if you're waking up and saying, I want to step up into a positioning that is going to allow me to be more of what I really am, and that's really great. Virgos, oh my goodness. You are so pragmatic. You're so detail-oriented. You really, though, are going to start giving in more to what means the most to you. You are going to start looking at what is really your big, big objective. Now, maybe say, oh, I want to be a gazillionaire. No, I'm not talking about that. You want to have more of a feeling of satisfaction and purpose in your life. You're not afraid to deal with the details. That's not it at all. But you're really wanting to reach objectives this winter. Dealing with the detail is a piece of cake for you. However, it is going with the flow that enables that detail work to come into harmony. So you're coming more into what I call the feminine side of yourself, and you are flowing with that. That's not always easy because you usually want to see the facts. You want everything in black and white, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it is going with the flow that allows you to deal effectively with those details so that you don't get yourself all twisted up into knots. And
your guest is with us.
And last but not least, and we've got our guest with us, I want you to know you are going to achieve more than you could have ever imagined in 2014. You've built your foundation, and now you're moving forward into where you really want to be. So don't give up. Well, that's for the three signs, and our guest, Frank Joseph, is with us today. Frank, I am so delighted we were finally able to reach you.
Yes, I'm sorry. I had a little telephone problem here, but we're finally connected.
Well, I am so grateful because your book, The Lost Colonies of Ancient America, is wonderful. I went through it, and boy, my highlighter was just tap dancing over so many of the points of information you put together here. And I love the cover. It has this wonderful image of a Viking ship with fires blazing at the bow, and the drama of the sea and the seagulls and the sail just filled with wind. It is fabulous. Frank, you've been on my show before.
Very kind of you to say so. That cover, I can't take credit for that beautiful cover that was done by our publisher, New Page Books, but it looks like an advertisement for a or something. It looks really terrific.
Right. Now, I am hearing a beeping on your phone line. Is there something that is happening with your phone line?
Yes, I've been struggling with that all day yesterday and all day today. I was hoping that it would be fixed by now, but apparently it is still going on. And I'm in contact with tech support and trying to get rid of it. That's one of the reasons why I was not able to speak with you on time. I'm trying to eradicate this interference, and it's unfortunate I've not succeeded in doing so.
All right. Well, let's just go ahead anyway. So for those of you listening, if you hear those beeps like I'm hearing them, just know it's a gnome that's somewhere in his phone system. You have a quote right at the beginning of your book by the president of the World Explorers Club, David Hatcher Childress. Much of how we reconstruct the past is based on how we perceive it. Amen to that statement. We are going through a major metamorphosis on so many levels in the world today. The reason we're going through it is because we're finding that the premises that we have established historically are wrong, and that we need to do a shift. History, because of the archaeological research that is evolving, is just knocking so much of this history out into outer space, and it's disintegrating. It's really a challenge. Frank, this must be exciting for you to be able to find out all of this information. You have been nominated by Japan Savant Society as the professor of world archaeology. You have seen so much of this yourself. How has this changed your life?
Well, I think it has changed it quite a bit. It's exactly as you say. We're living in a time in which all of the norms that we were brought up with and educated with are being shaken very badly. And there's major revisions on all levels of society, not just the past, of course. And I think that the big change was is that I was brought up, as most Americans still are brought up, with the idea that Christopher Columbus was the first and only discoverer of America in 1492. And what I've since learned is that before 1492, many civilizations, I mean whole civilizations, cities and empires, rose and fell in America, and not just the Aztec, but in North America above the Rio Grande, where we are now many times, and that the drama and the tremendous scope of activity that happened here is really amazing. And the question is when these civilizations rose and fell, what is to prevent ours from going through the same pattern? And what did the people in the past, what mistakes did they make that perhaps we're repeating now? I mean, the cultures that flourished here were influenced before Columbus, not by people from Western Europe, although they had a tremendous impact here, and not only the Vikings, but people going all the way back to the Ice Age, if that's amazing, but the Ice Age impact on North America is beyond question, but also people from West Africa, from Asia and the Near East and the Middle East, all had major roles in the prehistory of our country and really made us what we are today. But that it's a lost history. It's our lost origins. And that's what the Lost Colonies of Ancient America is about, to try to reacquaint Americans with their very important legacy, which is unfortunately denied by mainstream scholars.
Now, one of the many points of information in your book, The Lost Colonies of Ancient America, that I think is absolutely significant is, number one, there always has been a global economy. People have been traveling to different places on this beautiful planet of ours for millennia, and that certain positionings of powers that be at the time, whatever it was that they did, however it was destroyed, whether it was earthquake or an emperor came in and decided to destroy everything they possibly could about what happened in a certain period of time, I mean, human history just has constantly repeated itself. And many of these ancient cultures, many of them, not all of them, but many of them, were exceedingly sophisticated. And I think that too often we become so arrogant that we undermine ourselves as human beings. And we just think, oh, well, nobody's known as much as we do, and we're superior. And, of course, that has been a lot of the attitude of people. And so much of historical research, and lo and behold, we're finding out we have barely scratched the surface, and we better stuff our intellectual egos in our back pockets and sit on them, because there's a heck of a lot we need to learn. And that's what I liked about your book. There was a Cherokee artifact that you talk about that is a Sumerian tablet with cuneiform writing found behind an ancient stone projectile point in Lexington, Georgia. Now, Dr. Thompson talked about it, and the tablet is from the Ur-Nammuq in Iraq and dates to 2040 B.C. Okay. Right. Doesn't that impress anybody?
Actually, yeah, these cuneiform tablets have been found by the dozens across North America. For our listeners that aren't familiar with what the cuneiform tablets are, it's a form of the earliest known form of writing, which developed about 5,500 years ago in the Near East in what is today Iraq and Iran. There was a very great civilization there called the Sumerian civilization, regarded as really the first known historic civilization. In other words, they created great cities. They had a system of writing. They had great trading networks, armies, religions, and everything that's associated with a high civilization. And it's amazing that we're finding traces of the Sumerians, hard evidence for the Sumerians being in North America through the American Middle West all the way through the East Coast. And the evidence that they have left behind is primarily in the form of these rather commonplace receipts, written receipts. They are baked tablets that have cuneiform writing that have been translated from the original Sumerian. And mainstream scholars do not question that these tablets that are being found in America are, in fact, authentic, that they are real, that they talk about, for example, the one that you mentioned is really nothing more than a little receipt for a heifer, a kind of a cow, that was bought for a sacrifice to commemorate this woman, this young woman, who was initiated into the priestess of the moon goddess. That's all that that little tablet says. But I think that its very mundane nature contributes to its authenticity. What the archaeologists, the mainstream archaeologists, say is that, yes, these tablets are authentic, but they couldn't possibly have been brought here by the ancient Sumerians, because we know Christopher Columbus was the first and only discoverer of America. And so, therefore, there just have been some clumsy collectors who just dropped these invaluable archaeological treasures just by the dozens, at least, all over America. It's a rather preposterous explanation of the impact made by the Sumerians here. And if these tablets were the only evidence for the Sumerians in the Americas, we might tend to possibly agree with this far scenario. But in fact, there is abundant additional evidence to show that the Sumerians were here, and far more than just little clay tablets. There is a city, the oldest known city in the Americas. It's called Caral. It's on the Pacific coast of Peru. And its identification with the Sumerian city of Ur is so close that if you made a direct comparison between Peru's Caral and Iraq's Ur, you would see that it's built by the same people. It has the same sort of ziggurat construction, has the great stone ramps. Both cities were involved in cotton production. Cotton was very valuable to the Sumerians. Mm-hmm. And many other parallels. Not too far from Caral have been found additional Sumerian inscriptions, not on little baked clay tablets, but one is on a bowl, on the inside of a bowl that was found at Magna Fuente, Peru. Another inscription in Sumerian was found on a statue. Both of these artifacts are preserved in a world-class museum, the Gold Museum, outside of Lima, and that you can visit it and see these Sumerian artifacts. So there's no doubt that as long ago as 5,000 years ago and more, there were visitors from the Near East who not only came to the Americas but made a very important contribution to the prehistory of our continents.
Well, let's talk about, for a moment, in Port Townsend, Washington, which is in my neighborhood, so to speak, and the old world maize farming. There were discoveries made by Dr. Thompson of 21 American corn cobs depicted throughout Nile Valley art. Now, he investigated this for 2 years, and he said the Egyptian corn cobs are actually derived from a new world crop plant. They weren't supposed to be in Egypt, but the Egyptians were farming what we would call the new world corn thousands of years before Columbus was even born. Why is it so hard for historians to make that okay? Boy, just to get this information out, Frank, you have just accomplished so much in this book. To get it out where people go, really? Yes, corn was transported. We had global economies a long time ago. Give us a little bit more background on that.
Well, apparently the Egyptians, when they made their transatlantic voyages to the Americas, were particularly interested in agriculture more than anything else. One thing I should point out, that all of these various peoples that came to the Americas came for separate agendas. They did not cooperate, and they in themselves can be blamed in a way for the reason why we don't know, why most people are unaware of this early impact, because you came to the Americas from the ancient old world for very valuable resources. America has always been valuable in natural resources, and you wanted that as a monopoly. And as a consequence, you had a situation analogous to today's transnational corporations, which guard against each other's industrial espionage and have important industrial secrets. The same thing happened in the ancient world. So when the Egyptians came here for corn or cocaine, that was a big crop for them, they didn't want anybody else to muscle in economic territory. And as a consequence, they kept things very much secret. And when the ancient world collapsed, when it fell, when the Roman Empire and the Greco-Roman world collapsed in the 5th century A.D., all these secrets were lost. And it was only because of the work of archaeologists, mostly alternative archaeologists, who pieced together this information over time, the truth became known again. In this regard, Christopher Columbus is really not to be blamed for being considered the only discoverer of America, because he lived during the Renaissance. And this was following a period of dark ages in which all this information had been lost. And so the task of his time was to put together some of the evidence for contacts in the Americas, and he used that to cross the seas to become the first modern discoverer of America, but not the first ever discoverer. The evidence for Egyptians taking back with them large quantities of American corn, which have been positively identified by Dr. Gunnar Thompson that you mentioned, and other paleobiologists, botanists rather, is unmistakable. There's a place in Lower Egypt that was created by the greatest queen in Egyptian history. Her name was Hatshepsut, and she lived about 1,500 years before Christ. She created a magnificent and almost perfectly preserved monument, Deir el-Abari, which is in the Nile Valley. And on the inscriptions of her temple are portrayals of stevedores carrying American corn.
Frank,
that is not grown anywhere in the ancient old world, but appears in North America.
Frank,
Egyptians also brought back prodigious amounts of cocaine.
Frank, I'd like you to hold your thought for just a minute. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back. So please bear with me. I apologize for interrupting you. We do have to take a break now. We'll be back in just a moment.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. If you're just joining me, we're talking with my guest today, Frank Joseph, The Lost Colonies of Ancient America. This book is absolutely wonderful. If you have a love of history, if you want to find out about how peoples in the ancient world traveled around the globe, though there has been a lot of denial about this for a long time, now modern-day archaeologists, or as Frank would say, alternative archaeologists, are saying you cannot disregard the proof and the information that's going on. Now, Frank, one of the Indian tribes that you mention in your book are the Mi'kmaq Indians, along with the Algonquins. And they lived in a part of the U.S., and they had an indigenous written language. And you call it logographic, or composed of single symbols representing entire words or phrases. And there was a man by the name of Barry Fell, and he came up with information about this in the 1970s. And it was just something that was very disruptive. Tell us what he discovered. And has anyone come to realize that this really is real? This wasn't something he made up?
Well, Dr. Fell didn't really discover the Mi'kmaq written language. It had been known really for 100 years before his time, but had been ignored. The Mi'kmaqs are a people that live in upper New England. They've moved, migrated in that general area and into Canada back and forth for a very long time. And what's remarkable is that the Native Americans, so far as is known, possessed no written languages except the Mi'kmaq. They had a written language. They still exist, although their tribe has diminished tremendously, and very few of them are still in existence. Very few true bloods are still around. But the Mi'kmaqs had this form of a written language, and it was transcribed by French priests, missionaries, way back in the 17th century, so Dr. Fell did not discover this. And the Mi'kmaq language, which was transcribed, it was very simple. A few phrases could be made in terms and so forth out of it. But remarkably, the Mi'kmaq language is predominantly Egyptian hieroglyphs. And the hieroglyphic relationship, the Egyptian hieroglyphic relationship is anyone can get for example, Wallace Budge's lexicon of hieroglyphs and compare it to Mi'kmaq, and you will see the physical relationship between the two. And then Dr. Fell, what he was able to do was to show that some of the, probably most of the phrases in Mi'kmaq language, written language, are very close to or exactly the same as Egyptian hieroglyphs. Well, this was all forgotten. Dr. Fell published his book called B.C. America. He did another book called Bronze Age America. And when it came out, of course, it was savagely attacked by mainstream archaeologists. Interestingly enough, these mainstream archaeologists, in attacking Dr. Fell, never once addressed his arguments. They never said, oh, no, Dr. Fell, this is where you are wrong. They just said it couldn't be, and therefore it isn't. But they never addressed his arguments. And since that time, a growing number of scholars now, Dr. Fell passed away about 20 years ago, but since that time, a growing number of epigraphers, both alternative and mainstream, are able to show that, yes, there is a definite relationship. So what happened was, obviously, these Egyptians who were ancient Egyptians who were taking back with them Native American corn left something of themselves amongst the Native people and taught the Native people some basic hieroglyphics to help them in their day-to-day work. And it was passed down by Native American tribes who are culturally conservative, who preserve things very well. God bless them, because they don't have a disposable culture as we do. They preserve and value every item available to them, and including this written language. So this is one of the numerous proofs linking ancient Egypt, Pharaoh Egypt, with ancient America.
There was a find in the Los Angeles area in 2001 when an old house was demolished. And when they were taking the old house down, clearing out old foundation sections, etc., they found this perfectly carved rectangular block of a reddish rock. And it weighed over 200 pounds. And it was almost 3.5 feet tall. And it was covered with patterns of semicircles, straight lines, and at one point on the monolith, there was a human face that was carved on it. And it now is, I believe, in the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles. But they were just astonished with this. Now, here's something that was 5 feet below the surface. Nobody ever knew anything about it. It's been there for how many thousands of years? Wow, that was quite a discovery. What was the story behind that, and what did they find out about that rock?
Well, it was excavated by accident, as you say, by a couple living in Los Angeles, California. And when this block was taken out with these these designs on it and this human face carved on it, the couple took it to the Los Angeles Public Museum, where curators were able to verify that it was an authentic artifact, but they had no idea what it was or how old it was. They knew that it was not of a modern manufacturer and was many centuries old. That's all they could determine. The man and woman who found this block sent photographs of it to Ancient American Magazine. Ancient American Magazine has been in publication, celebrating its 20th year this year. It deals primarily with contacts between the ancient old world and the Americas. And so experts at Ancient American Magazine were able to easily identify the face of the character carved on the front of this stone. And as a consequence, they were able to identify what the stone itself is. The stone, which is, as you say, it's about 3.5 feet high. It's kind of a rectangular block, almost a cube, is known as a tophet, T-O-P-H-E-T. A tophet is a sacrificial altar that was used by the Phoenicians, who lived, of course, in the Near East about 3,200 years ago, began about 3,200 years ago. And this tophet is carved with the full forward face of a god who is identified as Astarte. Astarte was the Phoenician goddess of sea travelers, which fits in quite well, because if this thing was carved by Phoenicians who had to travel by sea 3,000 years ago, Astarte would have been the deity that they would have raised this altar to. So here's another example of another different people, the Phoenicians, who were known to have traveled very far and who left their mark as far away as California. And the reason why I chose that artifact, as all the ones that I mentioned in the book, is because I did not want to assemble all of the evidence for people arriving from other parts of the world before Columbus, but I wanted to assemble the best evidence, the most incontrovertible, the less controversial. And that stone, that Tophet altar found in Los Angeles, is certainly among the most indisputable proofs for the Phoenicians making a very powerful impact on the Americas 3,000 years ago.
There was, here in the Americas, a grouping of people that were quite tall. They could be called giants compared to most of the individuals in many different cultural environments. Most people were not over 5 foot, 5 foot two in height. Many times the women especially were quite short, quite petite. But in 1838, there was what was considered at that time the largest conical earthwork in the United States, and it was 70 feet high, had a base diameter of 295 feet. There were 3 million basket loads of soil, equivalent to about 60,000 tons, and this is located in West Virginia, and it apparently represented a time frame of pre-industrial builders in West Virginia in 250 B.C. Now, the people that invaded this mound were gold seekers. They went 20 feet down. They found a small chamber. It had a pair of human skeletons there, surrounded by jewelry. I mean, the amount of ivory beads, it was like 1,700 ivory beads, seashells, copper bracelets, and they found a skeleton of a man who was about 7 feet tall, and there was other stuff there. All of this was taken to the Smithsonian, and it disappeared. Give us a little bit of background on this and what happened.
Well, it's called the Grave Creek Mound, and our listeners can still visit this wonderful site. It still is in existence. It's perfectly preserved. At least the mound itself is preserved. It's a huge, incredible achievement, as you say, for a pre-industrial people. But all of the treasures that were taken out of the mound were sent to the Smithsonian Institution, just as you say, and subsequently lost. Then the two outstanding characters of the mound were the skeleton, as you say. It belonged to a man who was 7 feet tall, and at a time when people were hardly more than 5 feet tall in the Americas. He belonged to a group of people archaeologists refer to as the Adena. And the Adena were people that were commonly over 7 feet tall. The tallest example found was 7 feet, 8 inches tall. Now, when I first learned about the Adena, I refused to believe it. I thought that was completely impossible. But now even conventional scholars admit that the mounds of the Adena, like the Grave Creek Mound, often contain the skeletons of these very tall men, on the average between 7 feet 2 inches tall. The tallest woman found so far is 6 feet 8 inches tall. So this was a race of giants that definitely inhabited North America. This is not to say that they were all this extreme height, but many of them were. In the Grave Creek Mound, this man that was found was just about 7 feet tall. Even more remarkable than that, or at least as remarkable, was a tablet that was found. And on the tablet was inscribed a written language. At the time that it was found in 1838, nobody could understand what this tablet was written in, because it was written in a form of Celtic writing called Ibero-Celtic. Ibero-Celtic is a form of writing that developed in Portugal and in Spain about the time of ancient Rome. In other words, about 100 B.C., 200 B.C., something like that, 200 to about 300 B.C. It's a form of writing which was not understood, so this could not have been faked by people, as was originally claimed. Oh, the people that broke into the mound, they say, faked this tablet. Well, that's quite remarkable. they faked the language, which was not known for at least another 50 or 75 years. This is an indication that this mound, called the Grave Creek Mound, was built by the ancient Celts of Western Europe, because the Celts themselves were known as a very tall people. Seven-footers amongst them were not uncommon, and some of the graves that have been dug at a place called Hallstatt in Austria reveal Celtic men who were in excess of 7 feet. They were seven-footers often. So here you have the burial of a seven-foot individual with a Celtic inscription, which has been translated, by the way. The translation says basically that the mound had been built by a kind of a chieftain for his queen. That basically is what it says, that the mound was built as a memorial to her. His name was Tadach. Tadach, as translated, is also a Celtic name. So the Celts were here and they built that mound.
I don't know if you're able to hear me, but we are out of time. Excuse me. We are out of time here, and your book, The Lost Colonies of Ancient America, it is dynamic. It is a phenomenal read. Be a great thing to share with people in schools and that type of thing. Now, Frank, I know we're out of time. I've just been so delighted that we were able to get through to you so we could discuss The Lost Colonies of Ancient America. You have accomplished so much with this. Thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity, and I hope we can do it again sometime when my phone works better.
Yes, sir. This is Donna Seba. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
If you are an author and would like to be a guest on the Donna Seba Show, please send a review copy of your publication along with a press release to the Donna Seba Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for your material to be reviewed. Again, the address to send your material to is The Donna Seba Show, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497.
As a counselor, Donna Seba is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hello and welcome back. Donna Seba here. I know we don't have a lot of time left, so I'm not going to open up the phone lines, but that's okay. We were able to reach Frank, and I'm so delighted that that occurred. Are you getting ready for the holidays? Is your house all decorated? Are you, like me, getting ready to bake and prepare things? Because, oh my goodness, Christmas is coming up in a week, a little bit over a week. I just find that this year has just flown by like the wind. Because we've got the holidays here and there's so many wonderful events that go on in different programs, I know here in the Pacific Northwest, the Nutcracker is a favorite performance. And this is one that has been loved by adults and children ever since it first came out. And Peter Tchaikovsky, yes, he is the man that put together the music for the ballet, The Nutcracker. Now, how did this come about? It was between February 1891 and April 1892. He got the idea when he was traveling from Russia to the United States and home again. Yes, he came to America. Now, he had come into New York to help celebrate the opening of Carnegie Hall. But en route, and you have to remember then, it took a long time to go from point A to point B. His sister, Alexandra Davidova, she died. Well, he went into a very, very deep depression. And he was going to, well, it affected him quite deeply. So the idea, the original idea for the Nutcracker was proposed by a particular director of the Imperial Theater. And he had previously worked with Tchaikovsky and another individual. And they had worked on a ballet production, Sleeping Beauty. And he was inspired, this director was, Vsevolodsky, by the story of a hazelnut cracker that had been written by Alexandre Dumas. And he's a very well-known French author. And so the Nutcracker and the King of the Mice, if you've ever seen the Nutcracker, we all know the drama of the king, the Mouse King. Yes, well, that is an old, old story. And it's got Germanic background to it. So this was something, because in its original form, it was a very dark story. It wasn't a happy story. He shifted it. He changed it totally. And there was a ballet that was developed for the Nutcracker. And even though Tchaikovsky developed the musical score for this, he felt that everything that had related to this old Germanic tale that was very dark and depressing was transformed into something beautiful and absolutely delightful for people around the world. And a dress rehearsal for this was given in the presence of the Tsar, Alexander III. And that was done on December 17th of 1892. However, the critics, they didn't like it. They said it wasn't a familiar story, and they really poo-pooed the whole thing. However, the choreography, everything that went into making this ballet was absolutely amazing. And at the time when they originally did this, do you know children were very seldom used in stage productions? That changed. That changed during the Victorian era. So Tchaikovsky incorporated new instruments. He did all kinds of things. But do you know what? After the first performance of the ballet in 1892, Tchaikovsky totally destroyed the score. It wasn't reconstructed until after his death. And today, it is loved by millions. Families, it's part of their tradition during the holiday season. So the Nutcracker has an interesting history to it, and it's part of the holiday season that I truly hope goes on for many, many years to come, because it is a feast for the eyes, the music, a joy for the spirit, and it's a great way to enjoy the magic of the holiday season. Donna Sebo here. I do want to let you know about some of my other guests that are going to be coming up, and at the moment I'm trying to find my list, and I don't know what I did with it. So check on the show information site and you will have everything that you need to know there. We are running out of time here, and so I just want to say quickly, don't be afraid to step out of your box and do something different this holiday season. Maybe it's going shopping without more than $5 in your pocket and feasting on just what you can see, observe, and enjoy. Take time to really listen to the music of the season. That's something that I did yesterday. I found that last year, I was so busy being busy that I really didn't enjoy a lot of the magnificent music that has been designed and developed for the holiday season. Some of it was sort of medieval, other was popular. And we'll be talking a little bit about the history of music and how Americans really changed the modality of the perception of the holiday itself, and how it has become so delightful. We would never give up our Frosty the Snowman or anything else. We love it all. Well, we're out of time here. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have an utterly magnificent day. And we'll be talking tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.